Welcome to a special summer edition of The Next Chapter.
The Next Chapter.
You know, it's my first love, and it's kind of the reason why I decided to be a writer.
From opening that book, I became a voracious reader.
Humor has always been a vehicle for storytelling.
The Next Chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
Hello, and welcome to The Next Chapter. I'm Antonio Michael Downing. When you think back on your reading life, are there books you put down but they never seem to leave you? Almost as if you absorb those stories and lessons into your DNA. Well, on our feature, My Life in Books, we ask guests to recall those formative books and share them. Today in the hot seat is Zoe Whittall. After Zoe, in our second half, book reviewer Stephen Beattie will be here. He says that funny doesn't necessarily mean frivolous, and he recommends three reads that combine clever with comedy. Zoe Whittall can write. She has amassed a collection of award-winning, critically acclaimed bestsellers in all types of genres: poetry, short stories, novels, film and television. Except we've brought her here to talk to us not about the books she's written, but about the books that have written her, the books that have shaped her talent as a writer and her versatility, but also shaped who she is as a person. Zoe Whittall joins me from her home in Prince Edward County for an installment of My Life in Books. Hello, Zoe. Welcome.
Hello, Antonio.
First of all, congratulations on publishing not one but two books this year. First of all, slow down, because you're making the rest of us look bad.
But your
short story collection, Wild Failure, and your poetry collection, No Credit River, it's such an accomplishment. But I'm wondering if that accomplishment was less difficult than the challenge we've given you today of coming up with some books that define who you are and helped you define who you are.
It was so hard to cut down to just four because, you know, I had a long list of, you know, easily 30. It really depended. You know, I'm 48 now, and that's a lot of years of reading, you know. Do I start with Judy Blume? I don't know.
Yeah, I tried to put myself in your shoes and I did not envy you. I'm glad I'm asking the questions. Was there any book that immediately stood out and you were like, okay, this one is, I know for sure is going to be there?
Yes, the first two I definitely knew. I knew right away.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, with no more to do, let's jump in. What's the first one?
So the first one is The Passion by Jeanette Winterson. She's a UK author, and this book came out in the late 80s. And when I was 19 years old, I went to volunteer at a music festival with my first girlfriend in the summer. And we broke up while we were there, no surprise. But I ended up, it was a lot of drama, but I ended up meeting my first big love as a result. And when I got back to Montreal, they were in Ottawa, and we started this correspondence because we were both very broke students, and we would take these really sketchy ride shares between Ottawa and Montreal to visit, and we would write these long letters. And they had the most beautiful penmanship, and they would quote from the novel The Passion on the backs of the envelopes. And it was so romantic and old-timey and beautiful. And so I became obsessed with this novel, and it was like very different than what I would normally read. I was usually drawn to poetry and to realism and to present-day narratives. But so this book is set in the 1800s, and it's actually narrated by two different narrators. One is one of Napoleon's kitchen servants, and one is a young woman who was born with webbed feet who works in a casino, and she dresses as a man in order to work in the casino. And it sort of follows them through like all these strange circumstances as their lives intertwine. But the reason that I think the book spoke to me at the time was because it was very butch femme coded. Like the woman who is dressed as a man for work ends up falling for a married woman. And when they finally get together, she confesses that she's just been dressing as a man, and the woman somehow intuitively knows. And so this kind of romance was really hard to find in literature at that time. And of course, their love goes bad in the end. But what made the story so moving was the way that Jeanette Winterson kind of weaves into this historical narrative these little moments of emotional revelation and philosophical musings about what it means to be in love and fall in love. And so we did end up breaking up eventually, but we are still best friends 30 years later.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So that's amazing. So you had this incredible romance sort of intertwined with this book that you wouldn't normally read. I wonder, coming back to it decades later, how do your perceptions of it compare to when you first read it? I guess if that person's still in your life, I'm guessing favorably. What do you think?
Yes, I still think of the book very affectionately. And at the time that I read it, I didn't realize that Jeanette Winterson novels were kind of like this way that lesbians communicated. It was kind of our common language, that there were all sorts of books from that time that everybody read. And so now when I look back on it, I'm not sure if it's a novel that would have been so profound to me now. But I think because of the memories, it's still as profound when I think of it and with that nostalgia.
Right. So the time you read it has such a big impact on the impact it has on you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what's your second novel or your second book, I should say?
My second book is Heroine by Gail Scott. Mm-hmm. So this is a novel from, it's not in front of me. I believe it was 1981, or it's set in 1981. And I took it at a Concordia women's writing course. And I was a poet at the time. I had never considered writing a novel. And when I was introduced to her experimental it was like a long poem. It was like 200 pages of a crazy, weird poem. And I could not understand it. It was very challenging, but it made me rethink how narrative works. And it also made me think about how do we write as feminists? Like, how do we write about politics? How do we write about love in a certain kind of political context? And it was a huge influence on my first novel, Bottle Rocket Hearts, which was about the 1995 Quebec referendum. And so because in the book Heroine, it's the 10-year anniversary of the FLQ crisis. And
gotcha.
And she just really, like, the whole novel plays with time in such an interesting way. And it blew my mind. And when I go back and look at it now, it still kind of blows my mind.
So
like, it's so inventive.
Is it fair to say that you didn't think you wanted to be a novelist until it showed you what was possible with the format?
Yes. I mean, I always sort of had lofty dreams of being a novelist, but I think at the time, it was important to me to really buck with narrative conventions and to be playful and artistic in how I approached the sentence. And this was something I had never seen before. I didn't realize that novels could be that way.
Wow. Yeah, I remember I remember reading Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God and Kathy Acker's Empire of the Senseless, especially. I was like, what is this? What is going on? I can do this? It was definitely a, hey, you need to start writing moment for me. So,
I easily could have put.
You could have?
I was going to say, I read Zora Neale Hurston that same year.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay.
It's
funny
that could have been on the list too. Yeah.
Yeah. I reread that book every couple of years. I just feel like they're it's so rich. It's so beautiful. So, so we add in more books as we go. What's the next book on your list?
So the next book is Rat Bohemia by Sarah Schulman. And Sarah Schulman is a novelist and playwright, and she's become quite famous in the last 10 years for her political nonfiction. She wrote a book recently about ACT UP, the history of ACT UP, and she wrote a book that got a lot of press a few years ago called Conflict Is Not Abuse. But she primarily identifies as a novelist, and one of her big books in the 90s was called Rat Bohemia.
Okay.
And it's narrated by three queer people in New York City, alternating perspectives on the Lower East Side in 1990. And I took the novel, I sort of bought it at the gay bookstore in Montreal, and then I took the novel across country with me on a Greyhound bus when you used to be able to buy bus passes to go across the country. Mm-hmm. And with my two best friends. And I loved it from a story point of view, but it sort of felt like a primer for what queer life had been for my peers who came out 5-10 years before I did. So I came out in 1995. Mm-hmm. It was right as all the new drugs for HIV were starting to work and were coming on the market. And so, but everybody just a few years older than me who were teaching me what it was to be queer had all just lost dozens of their friends. And they were living in this reality of grief. And they were kind of in this live for today moment. And then everyone around me, my age, we might have faced, you know, homophobia and stigma and violence, but we were going to live. And like, it was really like a suddenly a different time. And so this novel kind of taught me a lot about what it was to be queer just a few years earlier. And it's also just like a really radical, everything Sarah Schulman writes is pretty radical. And yeah, it was very informative. And it was also like a fun book to read on a road trip.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting the trend with your list here. You tend to, there are books that have formed your identity as it's being formed. There are books that really are talking about speaking to queer folks, like dealing with being queer folks in the world, which is not always easy. It's also interesting that Rap Bohemia and Heroin have recently gotten revised versions published, or not recently, but many years later. What do you think about these two books has so much enduring appeal?
Well, I think they're both phenomenal stories. And I also think that they, at the time, it's not like today where you could go on TikTok and see 50 new sapphic books this season, you know?
Right.
Like there were only 5 or 6 every year that you could choose from. And I think that both Heroin and Rap Bohemia were just so excellent. And they managed to sort of now, historically looking back, really serve as reminders of what life was like at certain times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that. And why don't we move on now to your next book on your list?
Okay.
Number 4, so, I believe, right?
Number 4. So number 4 is Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts. This is not a novel. It is a work of auto theory, which is basically like poetic memoir and theory and philosophical musings all about a certain period in her life.
Hmm.
So Maggie Nelson is both a poet and an academic. So her writing is really interesting in terms of it can be really quite dense theoretically, and then it can also be poetic and sort of have a narrative whimsy. And it's about how she fell in love with a trans man, an artist named Harry. And while he transitions, she's pregnant. So it's she's musing about gender and physical changes in both of their bodies. And I happened to come across it as I was falling in love with a trans guy who, and I was also like utterly obsessed with trying to have a baby in my late 30s. And so there were kind of thematic links to the memoir, but I was also kind of transformed by the fearlessness of her writing and her sort of lack of concern for form while also kind of being formal in a scholarly sense, like having footnotes and such. And the writing is about love, both like maternal and with her lover, and also about like the tension between radical and queer while also kind of desiring normative domestic life. And the sort of the crux of the book is when she meets this lover, the artist Harry, she kind of had spent a lifetime devoted to Wittgenstein's idea that the inexpressible is contained in the expressed. And he found that unnerving because he's devoted to the conviction that like words are not good enough. And so there's sort of like these two really interesting people falling in love and having interesting ideas about the body and sexuality and gender. And it's like a little portrait of their life. And I was really transformed by it. And I think that it really informed the title story of my recent book of short stories, Wild Failure. And I don't think that I would have written my last two books had I not been utterly obsessed with The Argonauts for a number of years.
Wow. There's so much beauty in what you've said here. You know, first of all, I love when a book has challenging ideas, but also change the form. Like it's like the what is challenging, but the how is challenging as well. They're intentionally breaking the forms. And I always appreciate that. But this idea of words containing the unexpressible, what was it that was so hard to express? And for you, especially in your life at that point?
I think in my life at that point, I was having a really radical and transformative relationship and experience falling in love. And it was presenting all sorts of creative and intellectual challenges in terms of what I wanted to focus on as a novelist. And I was writing the book, The Best Kind of People, at the time. And it was sort of my most commercial attempt to date at writing a sort of a family novel or a social novel. And I was trying to figure out where I wanted to be artistically with that. And I think, so at these moments of transition in my love life and in my creative life, it sort of presented all these different ways of thinking about both of those things. And, you know, she's just such a tremendous thinker. I had to read it several times, and then I bought the audiobook as well, because she's just so brilliant. And I felt like I love to be challenged by both form and narrative and philosophy. And she just had packed so much into this one slim book.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I see that you're always, while you are wrestling with ideas and challenges, you like books that give you tools for helping in that struggle, is what I'm seeing from the trend is. So tell us about the last title on your list.
So the last title, so one of my favorite Canadian novelist is Heather O'Neill. And when I was in Montreal, I guess I moved to Toronto when I was 21, but so we were both kind of poets doing like performances around town, and she just always blew my mind. And her first book was called Two Eyes, Are You Sleeping? It was put out by a small press, DC Books in Montreal. And there were just lines in it that I had to underline and copy down in my journals, just the way she plays with language and the way she plays with imagery. Every sentence is sort of a juicy puzzle, and it can be so funny and whimsical. And I think that when I first started to try to write poetry and to try to write fiction, I often tried to think of ways to be more playful and evocative with the line, you know, and I think she's a real master at that.
Yeah, there's nothing like reading someone who's inspiring and how they're writing and the quality of their writing to make you go, oh, you know, I always like to approach writing with that energy. I'm curious, though, how does it differ reading a book of poetry? Because you write in so many different mediums. So how does it differ reading a book of poetry versus the experience of reading a novel? And how does it impact your writing?
Well, when I have writer's block, I often turn to poetry. When I'm trying to write prose and I feel like I can't get started, I will turn to poetry to inspire me in terms of the language. So it gets me thinking about language when I'm stuck thinking about plot or story or character development. Because that's why I write. I'm a language and a style person first before I am plot. So I really love plotless work. And I think that, you know, my first love is poetry. But it was actually hard to pick a poetry book for this list because there were infinite possibilities. But there were also like so many books where there were two or three poems that blew my mind, but the rest, you know, didn't speak to me as strongly. And so I decided to choose Two Eyes, Are You Sleeping? Because I felt like it was my first experience as a young person with a book that, like, I kept having to rebuy because I would give it away. Right. And even now with the books behind me, I actually can't find it in my house. I tried to find it, and I think it's because I lent it to a student, you know? Yeah, I just think that, you know, it's my first love, and it's kind of the reason why I decided to be a writer.
Mm-hmm. You love it. So it's so interesting. We come to the work for different reasons, right? And I find myself, you know, it was a big moment for me when I realized what I loved about the novels I like was philosophy and the ideas and poetry, the sound of the language. And
exactly.
Yeah, and not everyone is like that. Some people are like, okay, enough of that. Give me a plot twist. And yeah. And I'm not that person. But
same.
Yeah, amazing. Hey, thank you so much for your version of my life in books.
Thank you, Antonio.
I appreciate the heartfelt energy you put into these difficult selections. I'm wondering, what are you looking forward to reading next?
So the next book on my list is Ripcord by Nate Lippens. I love a plotless novel. I love fragments and collage, and he is very good at that kind of formlessness. His previous book was called My Dead Book, and it was kind of a book of eulogies and fragments, and this is a bit of a different theme, but similar. He kind of writes about a certain generation of queerness and a certain kind of outsider culture, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does with this next book.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah.
Zoe Woodall is the author of No Credit River and Wild Failure. She joined me from Prince Edward County, and the books she mentioned are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter.
What's first, last, and next on your shelf?
Hi, I'm Anne Hawke, author of The Pages of the Sea. The first book to make a lasting impression on me was Animal Farm by George Orwell. To say it took me by surprise is an understatement. I must have been 10 or 11 years old. I had a library card and was an indiscriminate reader. I read whatever I wanted to. The book was out on display. I picked it up and thought it was an elongated fairy tale. I was immediately gripped by the concept of a drunken farmer and the possibility for adventure and mischief from these talking animals once the farmer's back was turned. More fool me. I was despairing and sad by the time I finished reading Animal Farm. The novel got me thinking about how a story could completely upend my expectations. The last, most recent book I read was Not a River by the Argentinian writer Selva Almada, translated by Annie McDermott. The novel focuses on the legacy of violence, grief, and loss in a small rural community. I found it mysterious and dreamlike in the handling of its subject matter. The next book on my list is entitled The List by Yomi Adegoke, which I've just started reading. Ola, a journalist specializing in exposing abusive men, one day wakes up to learn that her fiancé has been named online in a list of alleged male abusers. A thought-provoking novel, stylish and smart, and so far, very funny.
Hey, what's up? I'm Jordan Astra. I'm from Mississauga, and this is Bedside Books. I would describe my music like up-tempo R&B meets funk. Think Jamiroquai meets Anderson .Paak. I've always loved music that kind of blends electronic and live instrumentation. I've been reading Shoe Dog, which I just finished, actually. That's the story of Phil Knight. And Shoe Dog is about, obviously, the story of Nike and just its humble beginnings and how long it really took to be a success that we know today. And also, historically speaking, how long Nike's been around, but also all the other great brands that have come before it that we now don't think of as highly as Nike. So a really, really cool come up story, and talk about perfect timing, but really, really cool. Shoe Dog came into my life because somebody gave it to me who they had received the book. It was like it was a pay it forward type of book. So it's whoever it had the book originally has just been giving it since. And that was literally when I got the book. They said, you take the book. It was given to me. You have to give it to somebody when you finish. So I don't even know who has the book anymore. But yeah, this is one of those books that, for as far as I know, is passing through a lot of hands.
Thank you.
Soulful. That was Toronto's Jordan Astra with After Midnight. Stephen Beattie spent a number of years as the review editor of Quill and Quire magazine. And he now writes and edits his own blog, That Shakespearean Rag. He lives and breathes books. And like most of us, he loves a laugh. So when he finds a book that does that, he's all in. Stephen joins me from his home in Stratford, Ontario, to tell us about three funny books he recommends. Hey, Stephen, welcome back.
Hey, Antonio Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
So how easy is it to find funny books?
You know, it's weird. I find it very difficult. Humor is so idiosyncratic and individual. There's no guarantee that what's going to be funny to one person is going to be necessarily funny to everybody. So, you know, these are books that I found hilarious, but I find it very difficult to find books like that. I find that there's a self-seriousness in a lot of literary writing that's kind of unfortunate, and I think there's an attitude among a lot of people that if something is funny, it can't also be serious. And I think these three books put the lie to that, because underneath all of the humor, underneath all of the belly laughs, they are deeply serious, and they're about deeply serious subjects.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that snobbery and why you dislike it?
Well, I dislike it because I think that it's a very facile way of looking at writing, at literature, and at art. I mean, some of the great artists in literary history, and you go back further than Shakespeare, you know, you go back to the Greek playwrights, Euripides, you know, was hysterically funny. You know, humor has always been a vehicle for storytelling. And if you can get people to laugh, one of the things that you do as an artist is you've automatically got your audience on your side. Because if you're laughing, there's a fellow feeling there, there's a humanity there. And, you know, as I say, one of the reasons I think it's so difficult is because not everybody is going to laugh at the same things. People often forget how dark humor can be also. You know, it's, we're not necessarily talking about, you know, Nora Ephron or Nancy Meyers rom-coms. We're talking about some really, really dark subject matter. You know, when people have written comedies about war, people have written comedies about death and suicide and so on. You know, it can be off-putting in that sense. You think, well, why am I laughing at this? And one of the books that we're going to talk about today does exactly that. But that also sort of encourages you to think about your own biases and your own preconceptions.
Wow. Okay. Well, with that said, what's the first book on your list today?
So the first book on my list today is a book called Really Good, Actually. It's by Monica Heise, who is a Canadian writer now living in London. She was a writer for Schitt's Creek, which I think is one of the places she developed some of her comedy chops and her timing. This book is a good example of what we were talking about in terms of humor being a vehicle for some difficult subject matter, because it's a book about divorce. The protagonist, Maggie, is a 29-year-old woman who has just entered into a separation with her husband of just over 2 years. And the book traces her first year as a newly separated, about to be divorced woman, and, you know, talks about her feelings of guilt about the relationship, talks about, you know, how she's assuaging her own sense of loneliness by trying any number of different adult hobbies, all of which she finds unsatisfying for various different reasons. She has a lot of casual sex. You know, she's on Tinder. She tries to navigate the dating world in the 21st century, which she finds almost impossible to do. And it's about her attempts to reconcile whether or not she has failed at her relationship, but it's done in a very, very funny way. There are all sorts of jokes in here, lists of her Google searches, which I find hysterically funny. She rides a line between humor and pathos, I think, very well.
Nice. And Really Good, Actually. Who does this title describe?
It's an ironic title. It's a highly ironic title. It's uttered by Maggie when people ask her, you know, how are you doing? And her response is, you know, I'm fine. I'm great. I'm really good, actually. She's not. But that's the face that she puts on her persona to try and deflect all of these more difficult conversations and difficult the interior monologue that she's having, which indicates to the reader very clearly that she's not doing well at all. There's a moment in the book, later in the book, where she has a conversation with a couple's therapist. And that's one of the places where Monica Heise sort of drops the veil. And you see that, you know, although she's trying to be very insouciant and very, you know, blithe about her emotional state, she's a wreck. She's an absolute disaster. But as far as anybody asking her on the exterior, she's really good, actually. And I mean, she's trying to convince herself more than she's trying to convince anybody else.
How does she get her life back on track? Like, does she actually get there? What does she attempt to do to get her life back on track?
I mean, it's not something that can be done. I think part of the issue that Monica Heise is dealing with in this book is it's not something you can do by snapping your fingers. She tries all sorts of things. She tries hobbies. She tries yoga. She tries axe throwing at one point. And, you know, she finds that is a complete disaster and a complete failure. She has sex with her bisexual friend Clive, which doesn't work out. She starts to see a very handsome man named Simon who she starts to feel is almost too perfect for her. And because of what she's undergone in her life, she's probably unworthy of him, and basically sabotages that relationship. So I think one of the messages of the book is that while you're laughing at it, you're laughing, number one, in a sense of recognition at the universality of the situation that Heise is dealing with here. Because if you know, even if you haven't been divorced, chances are you've undergone a breakup in your life. You've had to work your way through it. As the book goes on, you see all of the different ways she tries to do it.
Yeah, we've all probably been there. So it's amazing. Again, to your point, something terrible that made funny. So moving on from there, what's the next funny book on your list?
Well, speaking of something terrible that is made funny, people have said that comedy is tragedy plus time. It's, in my mind, incredibly difficult to make a subject as fraught as slavery humorous. And I don't think that this is a subject that any author could do. I think it takes an author like Paul Beatty, who is African-American himself, to tackle this subject from a position of knowledge about its fractiousness and how painful it is for that community. His 2015 novel, the Sellout, won the 2016 Booker Prize, and it was just listed at number 17 on the New York Times list of the 100 best books of the 21st century. It's a satire in the tradition of Jonathan Swift, but it's also a satire in the tradition of Black writers in America going back to the Harlem Renaissance. And I'm thinking of people like George Shiler with his book Black No More, or more recently in the 1970s, Darius James's Negrophobia. Books that try to address systemic racism in America by aiming a very potent light of laughter at it, to show up the hypocrisy, to show up the viciousness, to show up the nastiness.
So The Sellout won the Booker Prize, and Paul Beatty is known for his satire. So what happens in this novel?
So this is a book about a young Black man. We don't know his name. We know his last name, which is Mee, which becomes a point of comedy when he is brought before the Supreme Court in a case called Mee versus the United States of America. And the reason that he's brought before the Supreme Court of the United States is because he lives in a city called Dickens, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. The city has been decommissioned, and he's trying to figure out a way to get it back on the map because it is a predominantly Black suburb of Los Angeles. And while he's trying to figure this out, he saves an actor named Hominy Jenkins, who is the last surviving member of the Little Rascals cast, from an attempted suicide. And as a result of this, Hominy Jenkins pledges himself as basically a slave to Mee. And Hominy decides that, you know, because Hominy has built his entire life around the recognition that he gets on television in this very racist show. Now that show is deemed unacceptable, you know, he feels lost, he feels listless, and so on. So he's sort of thinking about, you know, a return to the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when racism was more prevalent and accepted in the United States polity. What Mee's idea to do is to resegregate the schools in Dickens. Bring back segregation. So there is a middle school called Chaff Middle School in Dickens, and his idea is to open up a school called the Wheaton Academy, which will be all white. So you've got the wheat and the chaff. And because of this, because he is basically flagrantly violating both the 13th and the 14th Amendments to the Constitution, he's brought up on charges and ends up in front of the Supreme Court, where he lights up a spliff in the Supreme Court. You know, he does all of these things that, you know, are sort of thumbing his nose at the American judicial system, the American system of what was supposed to be by this point, because the book was published in 2015, which was coming towards the end of Obama's second administration. People were talking about how a Black president in the U.S. meant we were now in a post-racial U.S. And I think the author's response to that was, no, we're not. And I'm going to show you that we're not.
What stood out to you in this novel about the institutions and the situations that he's satirizing?
One of the things that I thought was hilarious in this book is there's a group of Black intellectuals that congregate in a donut shop in Dickens, and they're called the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals. And one of them is a guy who is staking his literary reputation on rewriting classic American novels to make them politically correct. So, for example, his version of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is titled The Pejorative Free Adventures and Intellectual and Spiritual Journeys of African-American Jim and His Young Protege, White Brother Huckleberry Finn, as They Go in Search of the Lost Black Family Unit. He has another rewriting of Dickens, which he calls Measured Expectations. So he's taking all of these books from white literary history and sanitizing them. But at the same time, you realize that he's erasing all of that history. He's erasing all of that, what was, you know, what could be considered negative social issues. He's basically pretending that they never existed. And this is very much something that I think Mee is concerned about in terms of, we talk about whitewashing. When Dickens is taken off the map. He actually creates the borders of Dickens by painting white lines around the perimeter of where he thinks Dickens should be. So, you know, there are all sorts of little digs like that that the author throws into the novel. And he does this, scattershot, so that on every page, you know, you have four or five different references, allusions, jokes, and so on. It's one of those novels where, you know, you miss four or five of the jokes because you're laughing so hard at the first one. But, you know, one should also be careful to warn people that this is a novel that could shock them, that could offend them, because there's a lot of offensive material in it, but the offensive material is all there for a reason. It's all there to make a political point. So, you know, it's clear that Paul Beattie knows what he's doing.
Yeah, most definitely. And also fair to say, it doesn't sort of take a political side. It's more making fun of the way everyone talks about race.
So, you know, I think that's what good satire does, right? Is it turns the spotlight on the recipient. He puts it right in your face and he says, I want you to deal with this because these are things that are underpinning the American social psyche that you probably haven't even thought about.
Right. So your third choice goes back, way back. Can you tell us about the history of this third choice and a name, obviously?
Lawrence Stern's novel, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy Gentleman, was first published in serial installments starting in 1759. So when you say it goes back, it literally goes back to the 18th century. It's one of the foundational novels in English literature. I also consider it to be one of the funniest novels ever published. It is told in the first person by the titular character, Tristram Shandy. But the way Stern writes the book, it's not about Tristram at all. Although he narrates the novel, it's a 600-page novel. He isn't even born until the fourth volume. The whole novel is full of digressions and comic asides about his father, Walter, about his uncle, Toby, who is obsessed with Warcraft and Siegecraft, about Dr. Slop, the doctor who acted as the quote-unquote midwife in his delivery. There are all sorts of comic digressions about in the English class system, about the history of philosophy and the history of literature and so on, and jokes like you wouldn't believe. It still remains one of the funniest books I've ever read.
600 pages. It's the original of what Martin Amis calls the baggy monster.
A little bit, but the thing about it is, in its original iteration, it was published in like 200-page volumes. So people would, and it would take a year for the new volume to come out, and people were waiting with bated breath.
What brought this book up for you? Is this an old favorite of yours?
It's an old favorite. I was first introduced to it in a university English course. I'd never heard of Lawrence Stern before. I'd never heard of this novel before. But I broke into it and I found myself laughing uproariously. And I found that the techniques that he used, including a number of visual jokes, like there's a parson in it named Yorick. And I believe when Yorick dies, he quotes Hamlet, the last per Yorick. But the way that the book mourns the death of this person is with a literal black page, which is, you know, the novel itself mourning the death of the parson. And it's also Stern in a metafictional way because he was way ahead of his time. Metafiction wasn't even a thing until the 20th century. But in a metafictional way, Stern is commenting on the way the novel works for the reader. Which I also find very hilarious and very modern.
Yeah, so let me ask you this, Stephen. This is coming from someone who loves the canon and loves old books, but I feel like a lot of our listeners may not be as enamored as we are. So why would someone in 2024 read Tristram Shandy?
Because it feels so modern. It really doesn't feel as though it was written in the 18th century. It feels as though it could have been written last week. The style is very conversational. The humor is so ribald and bawdy. It's also hysterically funny, and I think that that's the enduring delight of the novel.
I love it. It's old school, but it's not moldy and highbrow.
Absolutely. It is absolutely not highbrow.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Antonio Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Beatty is a book critic and reviewer and the creator of the book blog That Shakespearean Rag. The funny books he talked about today are titled Really Good, Actually, by Monica Heisey, The Sellout by Paul Beatty, and The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy Gentleman by Lawrence Stern. Joshua Jackson started his acting career as a teenager. He played hockey in the Mighty Ducks movies. Whoa. And after that, I think it's fair to say his years on Dawson's Creek made him famous. And from there, countless credits, including The Affair, Little Fires Everywhere, Dr. Odyssey, and many, many more. And Joshua is now the star of an audiobook drama series called Oracle. It's a mystery thriller series written by Andrew Piper. Andrew was a beloved and popular thriller writer who unfortunately died last year. Rest in peace. Oracle 3, Murder at the Grandview, is available now. And Joshua returns to play Nate Russo, an FBI psychic. Joshua Jackson joins me now to talk about audiobooks and what he's reading and listening to. Hello, Joshua. Welcome to the next chapter.
Thank you so much.
Everyone these days is mixing up their reading with audiobooks, hard copies, e-copies. How about you? Where do audiobooks fit in your reading life?
For me, the beauty of the audiobook is there is a, I think, good passive quality to it. I find that the experience of an audiobook allows my imagination to wander in the way that I like it to do when I'm reading fiction. And also, frankly, I live in Los Angeles, so I'm in the car a lot. So, you know, to have a mental escape hatch, right, is really nice to be able to absorb. But I find flights of fancy much easier to digest in an audiobook format than, say, like denser texts, right? Something like what we've done here with Audible. These are the types of books that I actually enjoy listening to or... I listened to Never Cry Wolf, you know, as I like had a couple of weeks going to work. And that was perfect because you just hit pause, let your brain go for a second and allow your imagination to wander before it comes back to the text in audio form.
You mean Farley Mowat's Canadian classic, Never Cry Wolf?
I do indeed mean Farley Mowat's Canadian classic, Never Cry Wolf. One of my favorite books.
Beautiful. So, Andrew Piper is known for writing very chilling and creepy thrillers. When you think back to when you first read Oracle before you started playing Nate Russo, how did it hit you?
It hit me. That was the thing. It hit me. He creates these in a way that is hard to do with the written word. He creates textural worlds, right? And he creates the walls are dripping and the air is heavy and the characters are embodied. In our case, it makes the horror feel, at least for me, present, right? That there is a sense of threat and you feel enclosed in some of these spaces. And, you know, in the same way that I would read a script for a screen, right? You want to get a sense of like the presence, the place, the characters, so that you are transported into that world. And I felt as I was reading it the first time, I think I get this guy's voice. I can hear him in my head, which... both as a reader, but also as a potential performer at that point, I was like, yeah, I can do that, right? I see this world in my head as it's unfolding on the page.
So the world feels real. The voice feels really present and strong. And that brings it to life for you. That makes the fear palpable.
Yeah, it makes, like, to me, in the first book, when we meet Nate, stripping away all of the supernatural, he is going through a moment of crisis that I found to be recognizable. And that made him real. So then as that real person navigates that world, even with its heightened elements, it makes all of the other things feel present and tangible. And to me, that, you know, that's that's the first and most important hook, right? You, he, as a writer, can take it anywhere. Our feet have to be planted on the ground in whatever world he wants us to transit.
Believability of the world sort of sets you up for the story he wants to tell.
Yeah, like I'm a big science fiction fan.
So sci-fi is your go-to?
Sci-fi is not necessarily my go-to, but it has been over the course of my life because, you know, that, like, for instance, I just finished reading, not all of them, but I got up to Messiah, the Dune Chronicles, right? And so I love going back to this world because I find new things when I come back to it. And it does an amazing job of taking me to an absolutely out of my possibility realm, but allowing my feet to be on the ground there, right? It feels real and tangible. The characters feel real and tangible, even as we get past the original trilogy and go out into some more fanciful places.
Yeah, it does get strange and weird, doesn't it?
It gets very strange and weird. And I think, honestly, to less and less success, the farther away it gets from the story that it's trying to tell that relates back to us humans here on planet Earth, I think it gets less successful. But, you know, for me, that is great fiction. You know, you transport somebody to this place, you set the rules and dynamics of the place, and then you have to abide by those rules. So my suspension of disbelief can be maintained, but I'll follow you anywhere once we're there, right? Once I know what the rules are. I'm in this beautiful place in my own life where I'm right now relaying the joy of reading to a budding reader, my daughter, right? And watching her, like when she starts reading confidently and independently and the whole world opens up to her, I cannot wait for that moment, right? It's just, I remember that as a kid.
What's your daughter's favorite book at this stage?
Favorite's tough. We go through cycles, right? So what's on the nightstand today is this book called Night Owl. There's a series of them. And then we go back to The Giving Tree a lot and Oh, the Places You'll Go a lot. But it's a solid rotation. And she's just started reading. So now the first portion of every night is she reads a story to me. A lot of princesses in those stories, but that's all good.
She's in her princess era.
She is in her I think that's going to be, that's not an era. That's like an epoch, I think.
Yeah. Princess training, yeah. More like, yeah. But what about yourself? Like when you were at her stage, what was that experience like for you?
Well, I think, so at her stage, I don't remember, right? She's only five. But the first real work of fiction that I remember reading is The Hobbit. And both being proud of myself for getting all the way through it, but also being completely transported. Like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that these worlds were possible or available. And it just like completely opened my mind. It was the first time that something like big and heavy and dense that probably took me a very long time to get through, but took me completely outside of my world was available to me.
That must have been amazing. Yeah. I mean, all of Tolkien is a touch point for me and my brothers. Like we literally will have whole conversations in Tolkien. And so I can only imagine, you know, The Hobbit and Smaug and the dwarves.
It was a illustrated edition. And so somebody gave this to me at 9 years old, 8 or 9 years old, right?
Wow.
From opening that book, right? And meeting the fellowship and just getting into like, oh my God, well, look at what this is. After that, I became a voracious reader.
That's brilliant. Joshua Jackson is the star of the audio drama series Oracle. Oracle 3, Murder at the Grandview is available now on Audible. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate you too.
That is all for today. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews and Trevor Carter. Aaron Balser is the executive producer of CBC Books. And thanks this week to Sarah Cooper, Aronde Williams, and the CBC Books digital team. This has been an encore presentation of The Next Chapter. I'm Antonio Michael Downing. Thank you for listening.